Hello, my name is Shipling. You're listening to Total EM. With me, as always, when it comes to ATLS, is going to be Mike Sharma. How are you doing, Mike?
Chip, we are finally getting a little bit thawed out here in Texas. I see cement again through my bedroom window. It is thrilling to be out of the cold that does not paralyze the other 49 states when it gets this cold. But yeah, it's going to be here.
So, yes, and I can actually start driving a two-wheel drive vehicle again. It's kind of nice because it's been a lot of snow, but we handled it a lot better than those in Texas for a few different reasons. But never mind about that, because probably by the time this gets published, no one will know what the hell we're talking about with this polar vortex of 2021. But what we are here to talk about, Mike, is about Chapter 7 of ATLS, Spine and Spinal Cord Trauma. And I really, when we were talking about this and trying to figure out, you know, how we were going to go through everything and whatnot, you actually had a really good story back from Afghanistan, and I think can really deliver a really important message about like the importance of this and the sometimes subtleties behind this. And so I just really like if you don't mind sharing that story here real quick.
It's a real brief story, and in some ways I feel weird bringing it up. I don't have a lot of bad memories of Afghanistan, but the one I have the most heartburn about is this poor soldier that was in my battalion that was in a, we call them a watchtower, you know, and so he was a little bit exposed to the outside, and somebody somewhere, probably very far away from his outpost, took a pot shot at him, and this bullet, I mean, was a one in a million bullet. It went through one armhole of his body armor and exited out the other armhole of his body armor. Obviously, there's a lot of important stuff in between those two armholes. And this poor gentleman, he suffered a complete transection of his spinal cord. And we just all felt so awful about him. And of course, you know, talking about preparedness and talking about how you will not rise to your occasion, but you will fall to your lowest level of preparation and training. You know, we had not done certain things that I think we should have, because usually we would get great fast air medevac, and usually we would have very rapid transport times, very little time on our scene, on our aid station. But of course, the day this happens, this very catastrophic injury, medevac was down. Thankfully, medevac is full of crazy bastards, and they came and got this guy anyways, despite weather not being great. And I was happy to hear the other day when I asked about him that he is alive and he is well, and it looks like he's living as best of his life as possible. But he is still, you know, unfortunately paralyzed from the waist down. I say all that because that's what we think of when you think of spine trauma and spinal injury. But the chapter here, Chapter 7, opens with how we have to consider spine injury, not just in these clear-cut patients. I mean, you could just ask anybody and they could tell you what they were worried about this guy. But you have to consider this kind of an injury, spinal injury, in all patients with multiple injuries, with both blunt and penetrating trauma, and with or without neurological deficits. These patients require limitation of spine motion to protect the spine from further damage until spine injury has been ruled out. So that was kind of a long discussion of how we need to be worried about these things in all patients. But I thought that verbiage was interesting, Chip. You know, it talks about until spine injury has been ruled out. What do you think about that phrasing there?
Yeah, this is one of those things that, you know, we talk about ruling in or ruling out all the time, but as we're going to kind of dive into the weeds here a little bit, it's sometimes hard to, you know, technically rule out spinal cord injury in some cases. Like, what happens when they're incapacitated? What happens if they're intoxicated? What happens when you only have certain imaging available to you? Like, where do you consider it being ruled out? And when you're talking about polytrauma patients, especially those that are unresponsive, at least not completely awake and alert, then a lot of times you'll have where even after they've had CT of the C-spine or other parts of the spine, depending on what you're worried about, but especially of the C-spine, you'll have your receiving trauma center say, go ahead and keep them in the C-collar. And you kind of think to yourself, but we already cleared this in a sense. And the thing is that there are some subtleties. There are some issues where this can become a real problem. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But also just the fact of, you know, then you have the opposite end. You have someone who's completely awake and alert, and they're talking about a little bit of neck pain. Does that mean that they always need to have radiographic imaging, which is also not true? And then what about in special cases with scenarios of people who are awake and alert, but they're altered in some way, especially when you're talking about someone who's intoxicated and they're refusing to wear the C-collar as we're talking about protecting the spine? These are all these types of things that come up that ATLS helps address. And I think we have some of our own experience and maybe a little bit of extra information and data there than what is necessarily directly discussed in the ATLS chapter. But I think the big thing is, as Mike is talking about here, is this can be sometimes very subtle and can be easy to forget about or miss. And it's one of the things too, I feel like a lot of people are honestly not super comfortable about spine and spinal cord trauma, just because of the fact that we don't see it very often. It's very rare to have anyone who says, oh yes, I see this all the time outside of like a neurosurgeon, because they're going to get all those patients, right? But if you're talking about, especially us in the rural and remote environments, or those who aren't at, you know, a tertiary or coronary care center where you get all the trauma patients all the time, you're probably not seeing this with real consistency. Is that fair to say, Mike?
I think it's very fair. I mean, and it's not even just rural places. I live in Dallas, Texas, and I work at a level 3 trauma center, but I, you know, have level 2 and level 1 trauma centers within minutes of drive time from me. So people who have what look to be catastrophic spinal injuries aren't coming to my ER except by accident, perhaps.
Yeah. So, and actually, this is something that I want to kind of start getting into a little bit of content here. Something that I kind of found interesting. I mean, I've definitely seen it, but I think it's one of the early points that ATLS has in the red text. Remember, the red text here, if you're taking the test or you're preparing for taking your ATLS class, is going to be one that's very important, is that one of the very first things it says is that up to 10% of patients with the cervical spine fracture have a second non-contiguous vertebral column fracture. And I have definitely seen that, especially in polytrauma car accidents, where surprisingly most of the time it's a lot of fractures of the spine, is that it's not uncommon to see someone who has a C-spine and L-spine or T-spine fracture. Again, not like this is C7, T1 kind of thing, but this could be, you know, C3, C4, and then all the way down to L1, L5, anywhere around there, you could have these fractures that pop up. So sometimes you really do need to get the extra imaging, even though you feel like, oh no, this guy's really just complaining about his neck. Like, let's just focus on his neck and we won't worry as much about his lower back because, hey, he has chronic back pain.
Yeah, that's the classic joke in trauma, right? What is the fracture in the human body that's the hardest to find, the easiest to miss? It's the second fracture, right? We all key in on the first one and we don't think about how there could be something else going on. But as it says from the jump here in this chapter, is consider spine trauma in all kinds of trauma. The next thing that this book talks about is that, you know, the good news. If the patient's spine is protected, and we're going to talk about that, how do we protect someone's spine, especially if they're awake or if they're altered or whatever? If that spine is protected, then evaluation of the spine, excluding spinal injury, can be safely deferred, especially in the presence of systemic instability, such as hypotension and respiratory inadequacy. I think that is a testament to the power of the ABCs, right? D is where you get into your spinal issues. If they've got problems with circulation, airway, breathing, let's hit those first, especially if the spine's protected. We'll get to the spine eventually. It ain't going anywhere if you've got good immobilization.
Yeah, and this is one thing that we kind of talked about this in a previous chapter. I'm going to bring it up again here. If you are going to do airway management, though, with a C collar in place, this will make your airway interventions even more challenging. And this is where, personally for me, I love having a hyperangulated blade because I can get around that corner and not have to manipulate the neck as much. But that's just kind of a quick caveat to think about there. But something else that's also mentioned really quickly in the red text that ties in all with this is, and just reading here, quote, therefore, long backboards should be used only during patient transportation, and every effort should be made to remove patients from spine boards as quickly as possible, end quote.
Thank you.
Absolutely, 100% agree, with the exception of, sometimes I feel like it still gets overused. We're talking about to facilitate transportation. Now, if I have someone who is walking, talking, moving, and then we do the standing backboard thing. Mike, I know you've been around the block a time or two, but this is something that I was taught in EMS when I first got my EMT, and I thought, this is some stupid shit. And I mean, I had no real medical training at the time, right? Like, I mean, this is before I've even finished EMT class. I have next to no medical training at this point, but I knew this seemed like a stupid idea, but you'll still sometimes hear about this, especially in like rural areas that aren't up to date on their education and whatnot. But realistically, even now with hover mats and stuff like that, I don't know if hover mats trademarked. If it is, I'm so sorry. But
there's probably a pneumatic inflatable mattress. That's probably a good generic term.
Okay, we'll go with that. Anyway, you got the thing, you move the person. Like the nice thing is that you can keep them relatively stable, but backboards are still getting way too used. And a lot of people will back that up as far as talking about like, it's really only meant to facilitate the transfer process. But what happens sometimes, especially in places that aren't used to updates and trauma and whatnot, is that you can have someone who's laying on a backboard for literal hours. And especially when you're talking about old people, this is a great way to get those pressure ulcers starting that they didn't have beforehand.
Right, exactly. And we're going to hit that more in a little bit. The chapter starts off with some anatomy and physiology. It's important to know regular anatomy and physiology before we get into pathophysiology. We're not going to spend time talking about dermatomes and myotomes or encouraging you to memorize those things right now. The charts are available in the ATLS book. You can just Google those sort of things. I don't think necessarily that's a good thing in the setting of this podcast. So we're going to move past that. Just know, if you're very new to trauma and to medicine, is that there are, you know, well-known maps that will map, hey, if this muscle isn't working or you have a loss of sensation at this area of your body, you can try to map that to a spinal level. And maybe you can see, oh, maybe this injury, this problem I'm seeing is not from a peripheral injury, because you can have, you know, a cut tendon, you can have a cut nerve, and that can cause weakness and numbness. But if you have a certain pattern that goes along with the dermatome and myotome, then that might be worth considering as well. Again, what do we talk about starting out here is consider spine trauma in all kinds of patients with multiple injuries. So something to consider that's not a peripheral issue.
Actually, before we move on real quick, just because there are some that are tested on a lot and they're good to know, is that you'll want to know like the level of the nipples, the umbilicus, and then inguinal. And so, and some people will say xiphoid too. So, but the nipples and the umbilicus are like two very, very commonly tested one. And that's going to be nipples T4, xiphoid T7, T10 is umbilicus, L1 is inguinal. And so this helps you sometimes kind of figure out where exactly the level of injury is. And again, this is something that's commonly tested, which is why I just want to make sure to mention those. But like Mike's saying, to learn all the different levels, there are some great things, especially when we're talking about the extremities, about, you know, which one's the big toe, which one's the thumb, how does that all work? Like that's something that, like Mike's saying, is something that you need to kind of learn a little bit more separately, but know those, especially for testing. So especially that nipples is T4, umbilicus is T10.
I like that a lot. And I think that also facilitates communication very easily. You can just kind of eyeball someone. And then when someone, you're talking to the phone or a consultant or talking to a colleague, you can say, yeah, it's around the level of X, because you know it from other landmarks. I like that a lot.
All right. Sorry. So keep going.
Yeah, no problem. I think it's a great point. What I was going to go to next was the difference between neurogenic shock and spinal shock. And if we're not being precise with our words, these things can kind of be misconstrued and overlapped here. So neurogenic shock is from the loss of your vasomotor tone and your sympathetic innervation to the heart. And that's often coming with a higher level spinal injury, T6 and above. And if you can imagine, right, if you take away sympathetic innervation to the heart, well, that's not good. That's our fight and flight response. And so what's going to happen is you're going to have hypotension, you're going to have vasodilation, you're going to have shock, okay? That being said, the most common kind of shock in a patient, regardless of their mechanism of injury, is still hemorrhagic shock, okay? If you've got that spine stabilized, like it said above, work on probable hemorrhagic shock. If it does not turn around by trying to do the normal things you do with hemorrhagic shock, then I think you start considering your neurogenic shock. And Chip, I think you were referencing before we started this about the use of pressors and other things when you think you need to go there. Do you want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, sure. So funny enough, recently on previous podcasts, like I do as supplements to these ATLS chapters, I did one that was talking about pressors and using vasopressin primarily in shock states and trauma. And that was more about regarding the fact that, is this a good idea to do in hemorrhagic shock and how there's some debate there as well as other alternatives. So there was that part, but also I kind of just briefly mentioned about the fact of neurogenic shock and how this is probably a time where it makes more sense to actually use a pressor of some kind. And the idea there is that we're trying to help compensate with the heart. This may also be a time where IV fluids versus blood products could be appropriate, again, in neurogenic shock. But overall, as Mike's alluding to, is that most of the time you're going to focus on the hemorrhagic shock first. And something else, and this is something that was actually brought up with a recent MCRIT podcast by Scott Weingart, which is funny, the timing, because I was like, we're actually about to talk about neurogenic and spinal shock, and we're about to, you know, and we just finished talking about the use of pressors in shock and trauma, and he covered both those things in podcast number 288, which I'm going to include in the show notes here, but he talks about, like, one of the things that I found really impressive, and this is a guy who's, you know, had extensive experience at Baltimore shock trauma, as well as a lot of EM critical care. If you don't know who Scott Weingart is, and very well researched and very well read, he was talking about, and this makes sense as far as what, you know, Mike was talking about with T6 and above, usually being where you're going to have the neurogenic shock issues arise. So if the person can move their lower extremities, then, you know, unless they're really flaccid, you're usually not going to see, or he said it more definitively than usually, but pretty safely, if they can move their lower extremities, it's not neurogenic shock. And that makes total sense to me. But anyway, this is someone who definitely has a strong knowledge base and is talking about this. And I agree. I mean, with what bit of exposure I've had and with what I've seen is that they don't move their lower extremities when this does occur. And so that can be a pretty quick way to help you identify that if I have someone who's in a shock state and trauma, but they're still moving their toes and everything, then extremely unlikely that this is neurogenic shock.
I like that a lot. I want to compare neurogenic shock to spinal shock. This is the loss of muscle tone and reflexes that you get right after a spinal cord injury. Now, eventually, you'll get some spasticity, but in the immediate term, when we are probably encountering that patient with spinal shock, they're going to have a loss of tone and reflexes. Now, that can happen at any level of the spinal cord. So a traumatic injury to the spinal cord that results in loss of tone and reflexes below the level of T6, like in the lumbars, whatever, that by definition cannot be neurogenic shock. And that also, just by anatomy, is not going to cause that loss of sympathetic vasomotor tone to the heart in the central circulation. So that's a nice way to think about when I'm seeing a patient and it's falling into this pattern of injury here, what is going on anatomically and physiologically. Some more red text here I'll say is this: the inability to perceive pain can mask a potentially serious injury elsewhere in the body, such as the usual signs of acute abdominal or pelvic pain associated with pelvic fracture. And yeah, I mean, that's a very broad statement, but think of all the ways people can be altered and be unable to perceive pain. Maybe it is from a spinal injury. Maybe it is from what they took or injected or smoked before they came into the ED. Okay, so understand that when you have people who have, you know, spinal shock, neurogenic shock, just because they're not tender in certain places doesn't mean something bad ain't going on in those places.
All right, I want to cover quickly, and I do mean quickly in this part because there's all sorts of nuances here, are the documentation of injuries. And so there are characteristic patterns that we talk about when we're talking about neurological injury. The big ones are central cord, anterior cord, and Brown-Séquard syndromes. Or Brown-Séquard? Brown-Séquard?
We'll go with Brown-Séquard. I think the proper pronunciation is Brown-Séquard.
Brown-Séquard.
That's probably not right. No, that's probably not right.
Anyway, it's something. and Brown-Séquard, which I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, syndromes. Anyway, it's helpful to recognize these patterns as they can kind of provide some prognosis for complete and incomplete spinal cord injuries. So central cord syndrome, characterized by a disproportionately greater loss of motor strength in the upper extremities compared to lower extremities. And there's varying degrees of sensory loss. The syndrome typically occurs after a hyperextension injury in a patient with pre-existing cervical canal stenosis. So think about our older patients or people with lots of previous neck issues. And the mechanism's commonly a fall forward where they hit their face and it brings their head back real quick, kind of like a whiplash pattern almost. And so this is something that you can actually see with some degree in elderly patients in particular. Actually once had a patient who died from this kind of mechanism. And so it was a much more severe, like it wasn't just, hey, some loss of motor upper and lower, but I mean that just that forward momentum just snapped their neck and that was kind of it. Then the next thing is anterior cord syndrome. This results from injury to the motor and sensory pathways in the anterior part of the cord. It is characterized by paraplegia and a bilateral loss of pain and temperature sensation. However, the sensation from the intact dorsal column, so position, vibration, and deep pressure, is preserved. This syndrome has the poorest prognosis of the incomplete injuries and occurs most commonly following cord ischemia. Then there's the Brown-Séquard, and this results from hemisection of the cord, usually due to penetrating trauma. In its pure form, the syndrome consists of ipsilateral motor loss, so cortical spinal tract, and loss of position sense, the dorsal column, associated with contralateral loss of pain and temperature sensation, beginning one or two levels below the level of the injury, so spinal thalamic tract. And even when the syndrome is caused by a direct penetrating injury to the cord, some recovery could be achieved.
And yeah, just to clarify, hemisection, right? So we're talking about part of the cord being cut. It's not a complete transection where we have complete loss of integrity there. I think these patterns are interesting to know, especially in my mind, when I pair them to a mechanism of injury, right? So, and that was great when I talked about central cord syndrome, mechanism commonly with a forward fall with facial impact. How often do we see that? And it's really great to be able to hear about a mechanism and then go, oh, I especially have to test for this thing going on here, tested in this way. And I think that's a great way just to take a step back from ATLS, just to medical legally further cover yourself in the sense that, hey, this demonstrates that I know what mechanisms of injury cause certain injury patterns. And I especially looked for this thing, whether it's by history or physical exam or things like that.
And yeah, Mike, actually bringing that up, the medical legal side, I think is really important because while spinal cord injuries aren't super common, they do medical legally have quite a bit of impact, especially when you miss these diagnoses and something bad happens. So the fact that you can further support your medical decision-making by performing specific tests can, again, be very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, this is devastating, right? Like, so what if you miss someone's broken thumb, like a hairline fracture of their thumb? No big deal. But you miss some sort of unstable C-spine injury, like a Sciwara that we're going to get into in a second here, and you let them go, the long-term effects can be devastating. This person's going to live for a potentially long life with significant impact to their morbidity. So let's go there. Let's talk about spinal injuries and what we're talking about here. So, you know, there can be fractures of the spine, the bony spine. You can have a fractured dislocation. you can have penetrating injuries, and then you can have that acronym that I referred to is the SIWORA or SKYWORA. I don't know how you'd say that necessarily. Depends on where you're at, I suppose. But that stands for spinal cord injury without radiographic abnormalities. And I think it's what keeps a lot of folks up at night, in the sense of, okay, the C-spine did look good on imaging, but what if there's something else going on and I send this person home and they come back with some giant deficit here, okay? Like the book says, it's not easy. It's not simple. Experts disagree on how much you have to do to, again, throwing it back to the first part of the chapter here, is what do you have to do to rule these out? Okay. If you have some sort of radiographic evidence of injury, this is red text here, if you have something on your imaging, and anybody with a neurodeficit, no matter how slight, you should be considered to have an unstable spinal injury. And what's unsaid there, in my opinion, Chip, is that those are people who you still need to maintain some sort of spinal protection stabilization on after you discover these things.
Yeah, and so this is sometimes really kind of tricky, right? Because the SKYWORA is what I'm thinking of here, because of the fact that, you know, you have to kind of question, how far do you go? I mean, is this someone that you keep them in the emergency department to do an MRI of their C-spine? Is the CT going to be enough in most cases? You know, it has different factors and different levels. And again, I don't think there's a real clear cut. While they put in the red text that, you know, during the initial treatment that you want to keep these patients to protect them as far as an unstable spinal injury, what happens when after you get the CT of the C-spine and it's negative, but they're still complaining of neck pain and they still have limited range of motion? Does that mean you do an MRI right then? Does that mean you put them in like a Miami J collar and you have them follow up outpatient? I mean, it's not super well stated and put. And so this is when you want to pull in orthopedics, neurosurgery, general trauma, whatever you have that you can reach out to see about getting close follow-up and see how far they recommend going. But just keep in mind, it's really rare to have someone who has a true, like, unstable type of injury that we worry about, that the CT does not pick it up. I'm trying to find where I got this, and I'm fairly certain it was a previous Scott Weingart MCRIT podcast with it, but it was about the risk of that being 1 in 30,000 with a negative, totally negative CT of the C-spine. And so those are really good odds, but you still don't want to be that 1 in 30,000, right?
Yeah, there's still one out there. Now, something else, right, is neurological deficits. Is paresthesia a neurological deficit, or is that just something you can get from, you know, a peripheral blunt trauma? And so it's brilliant that you brought up bringing your specialists here, because at the very least, they give you cover when you decide to do or not do something here. It's like, look, I talked to an expert. Like, who do you want me to refer them to further beyond a neurosurgeon, right, or a neurologist? So yes, I totally agree. In these iffy cases, bring in your specialists and have them help you along with what they would do in the situation.
So let's go ahead and talk about some specific types of fractures. C-spine, one of the big things to remember about cervical spine injuries is that in children, and we're talking about young children, so when they are now skeletally mature, we're talking about oftentimes teenagers, now our risk starts going up more like we have with adults, and older adults are going to have even higher risk. But when you're talking about young children, the risk of an isolated cervical spine injury is very low. They talk about it occurring less than 1% of cases. And I honestly feel like it's even way lower than that, especially to have isolated, where you can run into issues. And the only times I have seen C-spine injuries in children has been in polytrauma. They were ejected from a vehicle, or they had some major event happens and they're hit by a car or something like that, then yeah, they could very well have a C-spine injury there. But the rest of the time, incredibly rare.
I agree. You know, sometimes we'll get these patients like a four-pack in the ER where it's the entire car of people who want to get evaluated after an MVC. And you talk to them and it's all kind of a relatively low mechanism of injury, and pretty much everybody in the car is fine, and you push on this kid's neck, and they go, ow, it hurts in the midline there. And for me, those patients give me a little anxiety, frankly, because it's like, oh my gosh, how far do I have to go? Do I need a CT scan this child and expose them to, you know, their brain, their thyroid, to all this radiation? I think knowing that this is a very rare thing, and also you hear about the rest of the people in the car and how benign their injuries were, that can go a long way towards risk stratifying and really having a higher bar, let's say, to do advanced imaging on these kids where the risk of radiation is not zero. So in my strategy for these patients is, let's give them some pain medication. Let's distract them with some non-pharmacologic modalities, something mobile with a screen that maybe plays Baby Shark or Paw Patrol, and let's re-examine them in that setting. Let's see if they still seem to look uncomfortable when I do a physical exam.
And especially when, like anything else, when you're examining kids, you make it a game, it can be a lot a lot easier to tease out what's real, what's not. Of note, though, with upper cervical spine injuries, this is twice as common in children than lower cervical spine injuries. And what I'm talking about is C1 through 4 versus like C5 through 7. So if they do have an injury, it's usually going to be to the upper cervical spine. And in adults, the most common level of a C-spine fracture, you know, vertebral fracture, is going to be at C5 versus the most common level of subluxation is C5/6. So that's something to just kind of keep in mind there. Now, did you want to talk about Jefferson versus Hangman fractures?
I do, and very briefly. Again, the mechanism drives the injury, right? And so when you hear about a Jefferson fracture, what is that? Well, that's from an axial loading injury. It's a 6-foot dive into a 4-foot pool, right? Where you have this top-down force. And what you see is this burst type pattern. And there is, better seen than talked about, a classic imaging pattern you'll see on an odontoid view. You have them open their mouth, take an x-ray through the mouth, and you'll see a classic injury pattern there with those burst fractures. Contrast that to a hangman's fracture. That has to do more with a severe, flexion extension type injury. And so knowing what happened to the patient, getting a history at the appropriate point in your trauma assessment here can help you further understand what we're looking for in imaging. Why does that matter, right? We're just going to have the CT be read by a radiologist at some point. But what do we talk about in ATLS? What do we talk about? Why trauma is so unique? Minutes matter. And so when you hear about a specific kind of injury, you can already be looking at the CT yourself. Are you potentially an expert in reading CT scans? No, but maybe you know how to look for these certain kinds of injury patterns that match your imaging abnormalities here. So if you look for that and you see it right away, you don't have to wait for the radiologist to call you with the bad news. You can start moving that patient even faster.
Now moving on to the thoracic spine. So I just have to kind of joke here. So a couple of weeks ago, you did not want to be seeing me if you had back pain issues after a fall, because I was 4 for 4 over the course of 2 days of catching fractures from falls and other mechanisms. And all of them were compression fractures, and you could pick them up pretty quickly on imaging. Did not have to wait for the radiologist to see that. So thoracic spine can be a pretty common spot for that, as well as the lumbar spine. The thoracic spine fractures, they get classified into 4 kind of broad categories. So we have anterior wedge compression fractures, we have burst injuries, we have chance fractures, and then we have fracture dislocations. And axial loading with flexion produces that anterior wedge compression injury, and that tends to be a pretty common one due to the rigidity of the rib cage. Most of these fractures are actually quite stable. The big thing a lot of times becomes pain control with them. And then burst injuries, they're caused by vertical axial compression. Chance fractures are transverse fractures through the vertebral body, and they're caused by flexion about an axis anterior to the vertebral column, and are most frequently seen following motor vehicle collisions in which the patient was restrained by only an improperly placed lap belt. So these are the people who, you know, I don't like the way it feels over my shoulder, so I tuck it behind my back, but, you know, I still feel like maybe I should wear the lap belt, which a lot of times you don't see anymore. People just completely don't wear their seatbelt. But chance fractures can be associated with retroperitoneal and abdominal visceral injuries. And I think this is really important because let's say you have someone, vague complaints, not super concerned. Maybe they're still in triage and you get a T-spine x-rays and it shows a chance fracture. Then these people may very well need to have further imaging, including a CT of the abdomen and pelvis with contrast to look for a retroperitoneal or abdominal visceral injury.
We talked 2 episodes ago in our ATLS series about abdominal and retroperitoneal injuries and how it's not always clear cut that something bad is going on because of that retroperitoneum and how you can hide a lot of blood in that space. The last fracture pattern in the T-spine is that fracture dislocation, pretty uncommon in the T and L spine because of just how the anatomy is, all right? There's got to be some sort of extreme trauma going on that disrupts those posterior elements of your vertebral bodies. The bad news here is that in the T spine, the canal for the cord, right? So we have the bony spine and you have the spinal cord. The canal in the T spine is relatively narrow compared to the spinal cord. So when you have that fracture subluxation or fracture dislocation in the T spine, that's really commonly going to result in these complete neurologic deficits. And so again, something to pair there. If you see trauma to the mid back and you have this complete neuro deficit, that's what you're probably looking at with regards to that injury pattern there. I know we're talking trauma here, but I also wanted to bring up the spinal epidural abscess. This is kind of like the big white whale when it comes to back pain in the ER, right? This is the one thing you just don't want to miss, and it can be hard to pick it out sometimes. And so I wouldn't doubt, honestly, Chip, if you have a podcast about spinal epidural abscess.
Of course I do.
There you go, right? So look that up on totalem.org or your favorite podcatcher. But one thing I wanted to bring up is something I heard recently is, again, we're talking about how it's so inflexible, the T-spine, right? It's very common when someone throws their back out, where do they hurt? Ah, my low back hurts. You don't hear a lot about T-spine sprains, from relatively benign injuries. And so it's something to consider when someone has more pain in the T-spine, plus maybe they have those risk factors for spinal epidural abscess. That can be kind of one of your more, another red flag, basically. Instead of going, this is probably just some sort of benign musculoskeletal pain in the lumbosacral region here, thoracic pain can be more concerning for your spinal epidural abscess.
Yeah. So moving on here real quick, just kind of talking about briefly the treatment. So simple compression fractures are usually stable and are often treated with a rigid brace, but burst fractures, chance fractures, and fracture dislocations are considered extremely unstable and nearly always require internal fixation. So while this is something that we're not necessarily going to be doing, we need to know kind of disposition wise what happens with these patients. Thoracolumbar junction fractures, so this is T11 through L1. These fractures are at the level of the thoracolumbar junction and are due to the immobility of the thoracic spine compared to the lumbar spine. So at that point where you have something that's much more rigid versus not, we can run into some fractures here. And because these fractures most often result from a combination of acute hyperflexion and rotation, they're also usually unstable. So people who fall from a height and restrained drivers who sustain severe flexion with high kinetic energy transfer are at particular risk for these types of injuries. And patients with thoracolumbar fractures are particularly vulnerable for rotational movement. So be extremely careful when you log roll them. So this is kind of like really, I feel like the big one when we talk about log rolling people to examine their back, why we're doing this and why we probably should pay more attention to that part of the back when we're trying to secure it for a log roll.
In my opinion, this is one of those times where you don't want to rush things. I know we talk about getting somebody off a spine board quick, but don't do it so quickly that you are compromising their anatomy here potentially. Because what's going to happen in these people who are a little bit bigger a little bit heavier. You kind of look at them and go, well, maybe I can get this guy or lady off this backboard and I don't necessarily need more hands here. But guess what? When you have more mass, these patients potentially have weirder and more unusual and at higher risk for more severe injury. You know, I'm sure there's some great, you know, physics equations that would cover that sort of thing as far as mass and acceleration and force. So in these situations, yeah, I want them off the backboard, but I'm going to make darn sure I have enough hands and everyone feels good about moving these patients with a little bit excess adiposity, because I don't want to half-ass this and hurt somebody in my transitioning off the backboard.
Really quickly, when we're talking about lumbar fractures, just keep in mind that because we're talking about just the cauda equina, the probability of a complete neurological deficit is much lower with these injuries, fortunately. So I do want to move on here, trying to keep things rolling since we have a nice long podcast going on here. Are talking about penetrating injuries. Now, Mike has already alluded to an example from when we were talking at the very beginning of the podcast. So these are often from like bullets or knives, and they can result in complete neurological deficit due to the path of the projectile or the penetrating object. And these deficits also can result from the energy transfer with something that's high velocity passing close by. So the bullet or the piece of shrapnel that is coming doesn't necessarily have to make direct contact. It can just be that large displacement of bodily tissue with the cavitation that then causes injury. And penetrating injuries of the spine usually are stable unless the missile destroys a significant portion of the vertebra, which is definitely a possibility, especially with direct contact. And then let's talk about blunt, carotid, and vertebral artery injuries. These are ones that I sometimes feels like keeps me up at night, because this is one of those, how do you best image and when should you really be suspecting this? Sometimes it's really clear cut, but then there are ones that can be a lot more subtle. Blunt trauma to the neck can result in these injuries, and early recognition and treatment of these injuries may reduce the patient's risk for stroke. And so this is the one that you classically hear about, like, oh, they have a vertebral artery dissection, so we put them on anticoagulation. Like, wait, that's the exact opposite of what you're supposed to do. But the idea here is we're concerned about strokes, and so that's when you hear about the anticoagulation side. Specific spinal indications in screening these injuries include C1 through C3 fractures, cervical spine fracture with subluxation, and fractures involving the foramen transversarium.
We've talked earlier about how aggressive certain EMS services can be with regards to restricting patients' backboards and C-collars, things like that. At some point, though, you know, when they come to you with a certain mechanism, you're going to want to do some pictures, and ideally, you get some of the stuff off of the patient. How can we do that? Well, there's a lot of these different clinical screen decision tools here. So one of the most common ones that was used for a long time is the National Emergency X-Radiography Utilization Study. We all know that as the Nexus criteria, right? But one that is a little more sensitive is the Canadian C-spine rule. And I think a lot of folks who do trauma a lot are going towards that. And like we alluded to before, you'll get that if you use it enough. You'll start to be as facile with that as you will with Nexus before. The book goes on to say that, and I'm quoting here, a doctor qualified to interpret these films must review the complete series of cervical spine radiographs before the spine is considered normal. That's really interesting terminology. A doctor qualified to interpret these films. You know, neither me or Chip is anti-physician here. Far from it. I love working with the physicians in my ER and all the practice settings I work in here. But like, it's just funny terminology, right? A doctor qualified, so like, a PA who has a doctorate, a nurse practitioner with a doctorate, that'd be okay. Some sort of a podiatrist with a doctorate would also be okay. So,
chiropractor, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of doctorates out there. You know, we have doctorates of education too.
So real quick on that part is that I think what Mike and I are trying to emphasize here is that doctor was probably just poor terminology there and really should be, you know, a qualified physician such as a radiologist, which if that's what you're going for here, ATLS, if you happen to be listening, then change that to radiologist or someone else who's qualified to do it, something like that. But the doctor thing is not super helpful here. So anyway, I look at that as someone who is qualified, who's trained to actually interpret these images, should be the ones who need to completely review these radiographs before considering the spine's normal. And then the second part of that red text there is, do not remove the cervical collar until neurological assessment and evaluation of the C-spine, including palpation of the spine with voluntary movement in all planes, has been performed and found to be unconcerning or without injury. And this is kind of one of those things that I think Canadian C-spine rules are going to be a little better about, because they talk about how you can actually go ahead and clear it as long as they can rotate their neck comfortably greater than 45 degrees. So they don't have to have absolutely perfectly intact range of motion. When I was doing my time in trauma on rotations and stuff like that, they wanted to see patients move every direction without any difficulty, and anything short of that got a rigid C collar and C-spine CT. And if that CT was okay, then they're going to move on to MRI, which obviously was a lot of money and time. And if they had used the Canadian C-spine rule, that may not have always been necessary. And the nice thing is, and this is something that our friend Ken Millen over at the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine has talked about, is that the Canadian C-spine rule, Nexus, stuff like that, can be used by EMS. They can be used by your triage nurse. So not everyone who walks in with neck pain has to be slapped on with a very uncomfortable C-collar. And I think we've alluded to this a little bit before. Maybe I have to make this as a separate podcast, although I think I already have because I did it with Min LeCong, was that rigid C-collars suck. They can cause some very significant harm, and that if you're going to put someone in a collar for a prolonged period of time, use a soft collar. And that can still be like a soft but rigid collar, like a Miami J, but putting them in something to help kind of remind them, hey, don't move your neck, is okay. But to have someone who's fully awake and alert and telling them that they can't move their neck and they got to slap this on there, and they've been, you know, on a car accident scene for the last 30 minutes, hour plus, and they've been turning their head all around and looking all around, and yeah, slowly they're starting to have some neck pain with it. Does that person need a C collar as soon as they come into the emergency department? I think not.
Right. Yeah. There is this kind of new belief relatively that, hey, if you're awake and you're alert and you're not intoxicated, you probably can do a pretty good job of protecting your own C-spine. Just the discomfort alone will prevent you from moving in a way that will cause, you know, worsening stability. You know, the classic thing we were all kind of taught when we were younger medics and such is like, you got to be worried about that person who is just going to whip their neck around suddenly and they're going to, you know, sever their own spinal cord internally and have like an internal decapitation and kill themselves. That's pretty rare, exceedingly rare, so rare it's not even worth considering when we talk about the harms that can come from prolonged immobilization here. The wording that we were using about voluntary movement in all planes, I think this is where sometimes the verbiage protects us in a way. Voluntary movement, all planes found to be unconcerning. Well, to me, I'm unconcerned as long as you hit 45 to the left and 45 to the right, like you said about with the Canadian C-spine rules. The next red text, again, is something where I think you have to read between the lines. It says that CT scans may be used instead of plain images to evaluate the cervical spine. I mean, for years now, I've been told, look, the X-ray is dead when it comes to evaluation of C-spine trauma. If you're trying to find a C-spine fracture, you're going to miss such a high percentage of these fractures. And like we talked about earlier, missing one of these things can be catastrophic for patients. So you're going to want to get a CT scan in all these patients. But you know what? I think this ATLS gives some nice concessions here for those remote or otherwise austere places where maybe you don't have a CT scanner. I think that with some creative and aggressive use of history taking and using your guidelines and using plain film if it's all you got, that can be, in that setting, adequate to rule out C-spine fracture.
With all that being said, it is possible for patients to have an isolated ligamentous spine injury that results in instability without an associated fracture or subluxation. And patients with neck pain with normal radiography, so talking about that SCI-WARA, should be evaluated by MRI or flexion extension X-ray films. And I feel like that or flexion extension X-ray films is really just kind of a nice way of saying like, hey, if you don't have MRI capability and it's not practical to get someone to MRI, then doing that. But flexion extension X-rays of the cervical spine can detect occult instability or determine the stability of a known fracture. When patient transfer is planned, spinal imaging can be deferred to the receiving facility while maintaining spinal motion restriction. To me, this is one of those, if we're trying to question, is this stable or unstable? Unless there's some extreme circumstance going on, such as weather-related events, and there's no way to get that patient safely up there, I'm probably not going to be doing those flexion extension x-rays, because a lot of times something else to remember is, yeah, if you're in a rural environment, who's actually overreading your imaging? What kind of radiologist is it? Someone who's just had some generalized training? Is this someone with specialized orthopedic or neuro training? Because neuroradiologists do have some specialized training with them. And if that's the case, then yes, they may feel more confident about the plane films that they're reviewing or even the CTs. But if they don't have that kind of training, then you may actually be not having someone who has quite the level of background, training, experience, what have you, to comfortably and accurately rule out that instability. So it's kind of one of those things that you really have to think about, not only your capabilities and your facility's capabilities, but the capabilities of the individual physician, that radiologist who is reviewing those films.
There's a lot of practice settings that we're not even thinking about, you know, with Chip being the country mouse and I'm the city mouse. There's a lot of other places that have to evaluate trauma like this, and lots of things to consider as far as who's available for consultation. Something I'm going to talk about here is, you know, we want to get good positioning for this imaging, right? And you know, maybe also to immobilize these patients, you want to get them in a certain position where you can immobilize them. But regardless of where your injury is, CT, L-spine, no one should be forcing a patient's neck into a certain position just so you can snap that perfect picture at your x-ray or CT suite, okay? You put the patient in the best position they can tolerate with regard to the neck or the mid or the low back, and you transport and you move them and you treat them and you picture them in that position. You know, that difficulty in moving can be suggestive of like, hey, maybe there's something more there. And if you're using a CT scan, I think you're going to find it if it's that severe to cause them to be forced in a certain position. Furthermore, you've heard us talk about the hard backboard, right? So just like you want to force somebody into a position, you also don't want to force someone to lie in a hard backboard. And the stat here from the book is that if you're on one of those hard backboards for more than 2 hours, that's where you're having higher risk for pressure ulcers, you know? And plus, that doesn't feel good. Doesn't feel good to have your bony prominences, especially some of these older or thinner patients who have a lot of bony prominences. Does not feel good to lie on that hard backboard. So get them off when you can do that safely.
I would argue even, and this is something that I try and stress to my nursing staff and everyone else, is that if a patient comes in and they are on a backboard, grab me as quickly as possible. I don't mind, even if it's not my patient necessarily, like no one's been assigned to it directly or whatever. If there is someone who's coming in on a backboard, grab me as quickly as possible so we can get them off the backboard as quickly and safely as possible. So that's one of my big things, because again, if you don't do it right away, the longer they're on that backboard, A, they're uncomfortable, but B, you're just going to delay taking them off, you're increasing the risk of complications, then there's really no reason to. And especially if I can get them on some kind of pneumatic surface that allows me to transfer the patient comfortably and safely after we get them off that backboard, all the better.
I think we've covered everything we need to talk about from a basic perspective when it comes to spinal cord injury. Just to sum up here, consider spine injury in blunt and penetrating trauma with or without neurodeficits, with other injuries or not. The way you would rule out, as they say, the spinal injuries really depends based on all the things we talked about, whether it's a mechanism of injury, history, physical exam, imaging, and other things like that. Just the combination of all those things is how you would go ahead and rule those things out. It's not always just taking a really good picture or holding somebody for an MRI. There are ways to do that without being so aggressive in terms of imaging and also with patient holding, especially during these COVID times where beds are at a premium as we speak in February 2021. As we also discussed, keeping folks immobilized when there's low risk of these spinal injuries is contraindicated. We want to get those collars off. We want to get them off those backboards when it makes sense to do that. And early. Of course, if there's deficits or if there's the patient is unable to protect their own C-spine, then maybe we put them on a little bit longer until they can wake up and protect themselves a little bit better. But if they're awake and they're alert and between history and physical exam, you think they can safely protect themselves, let's get them out of those restricting things that can cause additional morbidity that we don't want to add to the patient's problems.
All right. So I feel like we've pretty well covered everything here. One thing I did kind of think about that we really didn't maybe talk about as much, so I'm just going to kind of plug it in here at the end, is when we're talking about neurogenic shock, something else I kind of thought about was the fact that these patients, while hypotensive, just like hypovolemic shock from hemorrhaging, they're going to be usually bradycardic, not always, so don't rely on that completely, but they tend to be bradycardic versus your hemorrhagic shock patients tend to be tachycardic. And keep in mind, beta blockers and stuff like that can all affect that there. Steroids, it seems like less and less evidence to actually support the use of steroids in spinal cord injuries. But again, talk about that with the receiving facility to see if they want you to give them anything or not. And then one of my favorite things, and I forgot to talk about it when we were talking about dermatomes, is keep in mind respiratory function, because C3, 4, 5 keeps the diaphragm alive. So fractures and injuries that are above C6 can result in partial or total loss of respiratory function. And this is something that I use more of if I see that this is going on with this patient. I'm worried about a higher C-spine injury. And again, that's kind of a useful thing to help you remember where the level of the C-spine injury could be based on that physical finding. But I think we have hit everything, Mike. I think we're doing great. We're hovering right around an hour as we usually do with these podcasts, but so much information, even when we're trying to like kind of quickly get through parts of it. Again, this is a lot to know. This is something that's really important to understand, but I feel like this is a great way to get introduced into the subject. Obviously, if you have questions or you want things elaborated on, we can always cover that in more detail in future podcasts or like the mini podcasts I do after certain ATLS chapters. But Mike, I think it's time for you to give us the tagline.
I think it is. Chip, until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.